Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Welcome back. Good morning, Boker Tov. And let us talk about the Torah portion for this week, which is kind of, a large part of the meat of the Exodus. This is really the first portion that follows the plagues and, of course, includes one of the most famous miracles in all of human history and scriptural history as well. The parting of the Red Sea, or probably better put, the Sea of Reeds. And I'll begin this way I usually do, which is, of course, the way the Torah begins. At the end of the last week, we're in verse 17 from chapter 13 of Exodus, and it says, "And it came to pass," which doesn't count because that's kind of standard terminology. So what's the first unique word in here? When Be'eshalak, in the time of the shalaking, if you will, Pharaoh, et ha'am, the people. So, somebody did something. What did the Pharaoh do? He sent them out. He shalaked them. Now remember, this is the same word that we actually see being used when a husband sends out a wife, or even a plant sends out a shoot that produces a leaf. It's to send out. So I don't care for the English translation. It says when Pharaoh had let the people go. He didn't just let them go. He sent them out. He shalaked them. So the portion, therefore, is called Be'eshalak, and I'm gonna refer to this summary of some of the elements. We're gonna kind of be all over this morning because we're gonna talk about the key themes in this portion, but also some of the differences with what was going on then and what's coming now. And I guess the way I'd introduce it is by saying, you know, I like to talk about cycles and where we are in the cycles and what we can learn from the Torah, and knowing that even if the cycles don't repeat precisely, a tip of the hat to Mark Twain, they rhyme. And the other thing that's key to remember about cycles is sometimes the pendulum swings one way, sometimes it swings the other way. We're talking about a time when people have been sent out of a land, and they've literally been delivered from bondage. And I'm going to suggest to you by way of introduction that just maybe if we look at the cycles and see where we are today, the pendulum's swing in the opposite direction. So I'm going to call this one going out versus coming in. They were sent out. Arguably, what's the big argument you're hearing today in the United States? Oh, well, we want to bring all of these terrorists in. So we got judges saying, yeah, you can't stop these terrorists from coming in. And not only that, since, of course, the Ninth Circus ruled, and before that, the judge that exceeded his authority by any measure, he says, my imperial pen is mightier than the president's pen. Who elected me, right? And it doesn't matter what the law says. There's a 1952 law that was explicitly literally saying that that Trump had the authority to do precisely what he did, but that doesn't matter anymore. So all of this is kind of funny, but the argument is, how dare you say that these terrorists or wannabe terrorists or Muslims can't come in? Isn't it funny that in the days after this reversal was made, every single person, there was over 100 immigrants that were literally queued up and waiting, migrants, coming from Syria and other countries, every single last one of them, 113 was the number I saw immediately, were Muslims. Isn't it funny? As the story said, not a single Christian persecuted in these lands managed to get out alive, I guess. But if they did, they certainly aren't coming. Same thing goes for Hindus and Buddhists and you name it. Nope, all of the immigrants were Muslims. So let's talk about the theme and the compare and contrast, and I'm going to refer to this too as not just going out and coming in, but also kind of a continuing warning about the human condition. So big difference up front. The people of Israel who had been in bondage and were following the one true God, Yahuwah, and the whole message, of course, of this portion and indeed the book is Ki Ani Yahuwah. They shall know. Who shall know? Basically, Egyptians shall know. Moses knows. The people of Israel shall know. And eventually, everybody will know, the whole earth, that I am, he says, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And the key word here, too, is not just know it in I picked up the paper kind of sense. This is know it in the intimate, understanding, gut-level sense. Yada. They shall know. So a couple of the themes to kind of get us going today. Going out and coming in. We're clearly talking about in Scripture a time when people are going out. Who's going out? People that know Yah. Those that are, in fact, sending them out are gonna know Yah. And we're going to find out in this particular portion that it's a pretty dramatic introduction. It's the last thing they learn before they die. You will know. ki ani Yahuwah. And they did. The pagans, the oppressors, learned it, and it was terminal. Then later on in this portion, we're going to be told, Moshe is told, hey, you all, this is the plural, the southern plural Hebrew sense, y'all shall know, ki ani Yahuwah. And they did. What are we seeing today? It's not the people that are being sent out, it's people that are being allowed to come in. And what are they saying? Like it or not, you all will know that Allah, the moon god, is greater. Allahu Akbar. It's a lot of times the last thing various people in disarmed, gun-free killing zones hear before they're ceremoniously, well, in some cases in the Mideast, they get their heads whacked off or other bad things happen to them. Usually in the United States, at least throughout the Obama jihadist regime, it was a mass murder, arguably a false flag. It would come in and shout Allahu Akbar. Typically, there'd be more than one of them, but of course, the FBI handlers would disappear, the videos would never appear, and nobody that survives would be able to say anything different than lone gunman. Even though there are all kinds of eyewitnesses that usually for a while before they give up talking about it say, no, there were several of them. In other words, folks, what you're hearing me do is a little bit of cynicism here. No, it's a lot of cynicism, because if you're paying attention, you recognize that we're being lied to at a massive level. That has not stopped. It's accelerated. And the going out versus coming in part that I want to try to emphasize up front is just do the compare and the contrast. Here you have people who knew the one true God. They're in bondage. They are delivered by a mighty hand out of bondage, and they're even sent out. What's happening today? People who do not know the one true God, in fact, hate him. Some of them are here. They're making darn sure that others come in. And the whole key is, no, you all shall know, say the pagans, that whether it's Allah, the moon god, or Molech, or Baal, pick a name, Ishtar, the sun god, we got them all. We're going to make human sacrifices to that fake god, and we've not let your god into the school systems for years. Up until just about the last month or so, he wasn't welcome in the White House, nor in the halls of Congress. And why do you think people are squealing like stuck pigs? And I choose that analogy on purpose. Because it's all about making darn sure that the world sees that the battle is between the moon gods, the fake gods, any other god except the one true God. And the battle lines are drawn. So I ask this question as we look at these cycles. Are we headed into or out of bondage? All right, back to the story for a second. Because, of course, what we see here is that it came to pass when Pharaoh had sent, shellacked the people out. They didn't go the short way. That was near. They went the long way home. Remember the old song, right? And the human condition element of this is the following. It's introduced right here in the first verse. Because Elohim said, look, you know what? Could be the people repent. Now, I think a better word is they groan, they regret. I use the more modern terminology, they whine. They'll whine, they'll turn into snowflakes when they see war. And they'll want to go right back into bondage in Mitzrayim. Gee, could you imagine such a thing? So he led them the long way round. And of course, that is by way, ultimately, of the Sea of Reeds. Israel went up armed out of the land of Mitzrayim. Yahuwah went before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a fire by night to light the way. That stayed with them the whole time. And here's where the plot thickens, and we're going to see some things. And I want to return to this idea of the human condition. I'm skipping over some of the details of the story because I know everybody's heard the story, and we know. And I'll fill in some of these when it fits with where I want to make sure we cover today. But ultimately, the theme that I'm going to connect with the human condition has to do with this repetitive modality. How's that for a word? Of whining. In this portion alone, we see the whining come back at least three separate times. The first reference, of course, we've just talked about, the long way home. And it's Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh saying, because they just might whine. I've already got this plan in place. Which brings me to chapter 14, verse 10. And we'll lead into this one. Okay, speak to the children of Israel, says Yahuwah to Moshe. Here's what's going to happen. We're going to send you a particular route. Pharaoh is going to see it. He's going to say of the children of Israel, ha ha, they're right where I want them. They have fallen into the trap. And, oh, by the way, just in case, I will make strong. I'm going to Kazakhify. I will strengthen, stiffen his backbone, we might say nowadays, but I'm going to strengthen Pharaoh's heart. And he will, in fact, follow after them. Not only did he follow after them, folks, the sages say he was so hot to trot, he prepared his own chariots. He was angry. He was filled with bloodlust. Yahuwah says, I will get me honor upon Pharaoh, upon all of his host. And, here comes, the Egyptians, the people of Mitzrayim, shall know. Ki ani Yahuwah. All right, so Pharaoh was told where they fled. Like I said, he made ready his own chariot. He took 600 of his best and brightest. He basically took his entire tank crew and everything he had, and he brought them into battle. And Yahuwah hardened the heart, second time, made strong the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. He pursued after them, all of the king's horses, all the king's men, all the king's chariots, and they caught him. They caught him in what looked like a box canyon between, hell and high water, literally. The sea. Children of Israel, here comes the whining. Pharaoh drew nigh. The children of Israel look up. They see the most powerful army in the entire world fixing to march down on them in no uncertain terms. They were sore afraid. Yare is the root word there, right? Yaru, they were all afraid, and they did exactly what you'd expect. And this is indeed, I think, part of the key element of the story. They cried out. This time they cried out to Yahuwah. But they also whined. They said unto Moshe, first whine in the story. Why? Why did you bring us out here? Because there's no graves in Mitzrayim? You brought us out here to die in the wilderness? Why'd you do this to us? Oh, we would have been so happy just to stay there and be slaves. Now, forget that we were whining about that, too. But no, now we're going to whine about this. It was better for us to serve the Egyptians than here to die in the wilderness, right? Better red than dead. Some of us that are old enough have heard that. Now, of course, whether we know it or not, we are pretty much red. Moshe then says, what I'm going to suggest is the key verse in the entire portion, one of the key verses in the story, and this is one I'm going to return to as well. Now, this is essentially chapter 14, verse 13 of Exodus, Shemot. Moshe says to the people, fear not. Most repeated commandment in Scripture, supposedly about 900 times that word appears one way or the other, fear not. All of you. And then we get this. Stand still and see. Two verbs. Stand still and see. What are they going to see? They're going to see Yeshuat, Yahuwah. That word there, et, the pointer, Aleph Tav, means here's what you're going to see. Right? It's the thing that says the direct object is coming. See Yeshuat, Yahuwah. Now, people recognize that root word. It was the same word that was later given to the baby that was born, and the messenger said, yep, this is what you're going to call him, because he will save, he will Shua his people. So his name will be Yah's, if you will. We'll Englishify it just a bit. Yah's salvation. You don't get that when you change the word and change the pronunciation into something that means absolutely nothing. So I contend that his full, properly pronounced name, the name that comes closest anyway, ought to be Yahushua, the salvation of Yahu, or Yahu's salvation. And you can translate, or you can, yeah, if you want to make that a familiar, put it in the nickname for him, Yeshua. Got no problem with that. But when we start turning into something Latin that doesn't mean anything, we've lost the whole point of the story. And indeed, that's part of the reason why this doesn't stick out to a lot of people that have ignored the rest of this story, too, because also in this one, we're going to find out about the Shabbat, the Sabbath, and a whole bunch of other things that people have been lied to about for years. Told, oh, doesn't apply anymore, done away with, nailed to the cross. Fear not, though it says here, fear not, be still. You ever heard this phrase? Be still and know that I am Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Hey, be still and know that I am Elohim. Slightly different words. That's from Psalm 46:10. But it's interesting, because most people, when they see this, they may think of Psalm 46. That's probably more famous terminology. Be still and know that I am God. But It's interesting, if you read the psalm, it's a psalm of the sons of Korah. The next line, still part of the same verse, says, "Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the Goyim." The King James usually renders it the heathens. Sometimes you'll see it as the nations. But this is usually among people that don't know me. And it's ironic, of course, that a lot of Christians will call themselves Goyim or even pagans or Gentiles. And it's too bad, because this is the commandment. Be still and know that I am who I say I am. If we don't know his character, if we pay no attention to what he says to do, is it true? Are we being still and knowing him or not? Again, back to the cycles. Are we going out or coming in? The human condition, at least, remains. There's still a lot of whining going on. All right, Yahuwah says, one more line from Moshe. Moshe says, hey, check it out. These fellows from Mitzrayim, these Egyptians you're seeing today, you ain't never gonna see them again forever. Well, there's a little bit of an interesting nuance to that, because they are, in fact, pretty soon going to see them one last time. They're going to see the bodies wash up on the shore, and they will literally, in a lot of cases, recognize them. So Moses' point is made. You're not going to see them alive, not the way they are right now, again forever, so take a good look. But as far as the emotional impact, yeah, be still and know, and by the way, you're going to see a whole lot more than you yet completely understand. You will, in fact, yada. Yahuwah will fight for you. You will just stand here and hold your peace. Well, says Yahuwah to Moshe, why aren't you crying out to me? Tell them to get on it. Go forward. Move, journey. So, Moshe lifts up his rod. You know the rest of the story. The east wind blew throughout the night. There's a lot we could say on this score, and I sometimes talk about it along with the minimum necessary miracle. And sometimes the point of my mentioning the minimum necessary miracle is that it's whatever it is that the Creator needs to suit his purposes. That's kind of the way I see it. Now, this, of course, is markology. It's my interpretation, the way I would connect the dots. Your mileage may vary. You don't have to believe it. But certainly we've seen places where something can be perceived, and indeed is, a clear miracle. But it's not one that you might call of biblical proportions. It doesn't require the sea to be parted. But sometimes, and indeed this one, it does. And this is one that has been written about. This is one, of course, that those who would like to invite in the people who hate God and ignore the scriptures and say it never really happened, and he's not welcome in the schools anyway, we don't talk about that old stuff, tend to ignore any evidence, any proof that that shows, no, it did happen. That's part of the reason why the Red Sea versus the Sea of Reeds is an interesting distinction. And you got people nowadays saying, oh, see, it was supposed to have happened in the wrong place. That's why the clues, the archaeological evidence was missed and so forth. But in any case, the minimum necessary miracle principle is the thing that I'm emphasizing here, simply because we're going to see it throughout this portion of the story, this incident in this longer story. We know it's going to happen. The cloud will eventually reposition, not between the armies of Pharaoh and the people of Israel, but behind Pharaoh, kind of cutting off his escape. He's going to continue to strengthen their hearts. They're going to rush in where angels fear to tread. It'll be the last thing they ever do. The people of Israel will walk through on the dry ground after the seas have parted for them. Not so much for the chariots. They get stuck in the muck, and eventually every single last man drowns. Egyptians pursue. All the king's horses, his chariots and his horsemen. And eventually, of course, what happens? Waters return, cover the chariots, all of them. Not so much as one remained. The children of Israel walked upon dry land, waters on their left and on their right. And it says here, Yahushua'd Israel that day out of the land of the Egyptians. And then, here comes the yada part, you will know how. Israel saw these oppressors, the people who had held them in bondage, dead upon the seashore. And the sages point out, and I think this is a reasonable extension of the story, here's a slightly less dramatic miracle, but nevertheless one that fits and makes the point. I can imagine, and the claim, of course, is this is exactly what happened. Lots and lots of individual children of Israel walking, looking upon this swarm of dead bodies washing up on the shore and saying, oh, there was Mahmud, the guy who was whipping me just a few weeks back. You know, here was that evil overseer that took away our straw. Here are all these people, basically, that were doing all this nasty stuff to us, and there they are. They're kind of bloated and blue-looking, but I recognize the face. Verse 31 summarizes it. Israel, it says, saw. They, Yareh, the great work which Yahuwah did upon those Egyptians, and the people, Yareh, too, Yahuwah. They feared and saw, and in fact, believed. They believed that what he said he was going to do, he in fact had done. They had proof firsthand, and they therefore, presumably, began to suspect, you know what, when he makes promises in the future, that's the nature of his character. He will do what he will do. Maybe that's even the reason why he keeps telling us the same thing. The point is being made in every which way here. Minimum necessary miracles and lots of them. They not only believed Yahuwah, they also believed in and believed, they listened to and they walked in obedience to his servant Moshe. Next verse, and indeed the next chapter says they sang the song. One of the keys here, and I think this is all I want to say about the song at this point. Yahuwah is a man of war, says the King James. I like Rashi, the Hebrew scholar's translation a bit better. He says, yeah, the word there is ish, but if you understand it in the context and the way it's used here, he is really saying he's not a man of war. He is what we would say nowadays, right, in the vernacular. He's the man! He is the master of war. Yahuwah is Shemo, that's his name. He's the master of war. And I like to hearken back to the idea of a chess master. Somebody who really knows the game is a grandmaster, a chess master. Names like Capablanca and Bobby Fischer and Alekhine and other famous names. Boris Kasparov. You can, even if you don't play chess, I've studied some of the works of the masters, some of their famous chess games. And it's fun to see the brilliance of the true masters of the art of, in this case, war on a chessboard. We're talking about here the master, the man of war. Pharaoh found out that when it comes to making war, you're a child. As a matter of fact, you're a dead child. Who is greater? Allahu Akbar? Hardly. We're talking about the master of war. He is a master of many other things too, but don't presume, in other words, that Allah is in fact really greater. Those who understand that are headed out of bondage. Those who don't are headed into bondage. All right, back to the whining, because that's literally where we're going to go next. We see that after all this happens, horses of Pharaoh, says the end of the song, went into the sea. The waters came back over. Israel walked on dry land. And then we come to Miriam. Wait a minute. Isn't that interesting? It's the first time Miriam is named. Now, she's Moshe's older sister. She appears in the story a bunch of times, but here now we see her name, and it's interesting that her name actually has the root having to do with rebellion in first use, Miriam. And it also says in verse 20, when Miriam is introduced to us, two things. Now, there's a whole lot of, let's just say, Midrash oral tradition about the story. What did Miriam say? You know, did she have some conversations with her parents before the baby was born? And honestly, they may or may not be true. Can't prove them. I don't put a lot of stock in that and don't tend to teach them. But when I see connections that are made that do, in fact, resonate with Scripture, I think those are worth pointing out. And one of them is the following. Miriam, as we know, has two brothers. Two brothers that appear prominently throughout the story. One's name is Aaron. He's the older one. And we got this younger one. She's older than him, Moshe. Right? She was watching Moshe float down the Nile River. And what happened at that point when she was watching Moshe float down the Nile River? Remember back to the story? It says she stood still from afar off and watched what happened on the waters. Isn't that amazing? What does this verse tell us? It says Miriam here, first time we see her name, is a prophetess. She is a Navia. Why is that important? Well, the sages will say because she prophesied all kinds of things that we can't prove. But this at least does make sense. And we're going to find out later that she is a prophetess. But it also says not only is she that, she is the sister of Aaron. Why not both of them? She's Moses' sister too. Well, she takes a timbrel, she goes out and she sings and dances, and she sang the song, Sing to Yahuwah, for he is highly exalted, the horse and the rider, he's thrown into the sea. Famous words. But I think the connection here is what is really interesting. She's a prophetess, she is the sister of only Aaron, as mentioned at this time, and it does seem to hearken back to the other place where she stood still and watched what happened. And it brings us full circle in this story of Moshe. The fellow who at that point, literally as part of the plan of Yah, was put into the water, drawn out by, of all people, daughter of Pharaoh, for crying out loud. Now you gotta figure if this little girl, Miriam, who isn't even named at that point, is watching this and recognizes what's going on here, she might have thought, oh, no! Well, for crying out loud, look who's coming to get my little bro! It's daughter of Pharaoh! Oh, no! But that's not what happens. She stood still, and she knew. She watched. Maybe she is, in fact, the kind of prophetess who knew what was going to happen, and that's why she stood still. We don't know any of that. But what we do know is that the connections here are, well, another one of these miracles. Something else that helps us to see the story and recognize how incredible and how important all of this is. On we go. Moshe led Israel away from the Sea of Reeds. They went out into the wilderness, Bamidbar, this place called Shur, and they spent 3 days out there without water. Guess what's going to happen? Right? You know there's some whining at hand, probably because we've read the story, but this is the second of two. We had the whining when they were trapped by Pharaoh. That at least set up the important part. And I would say again, you gotta give them that one. Okay? A lot of times when people are staring at death in the face, that's a natural reaction. If they don't think there's anything they can do. They may want to whine. Okay? So I'm not necessarily faulting people for the fact that we're human anyway. The point is, they were told, fear not, be still, and watch. And they saw. Now we got a slightly different situation. They're at this place where there's no water. They came to this place where, it's been named Marah because it means bitter, because waters were Marah. So the name of the place was called Marah. All of this makes sense. It's another one of those places where if you understand the Hebrew, it makes a lot more sense. At least in this case, the translators didn't change the name to Marus or something like that to try and hide the point. What did the people do? Well, they whined. They murmured. Again, they're murmuring against Moshe. What are we going to drink? They cried out. All right, not so bad. He, in fact, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh in this case, shows Moshe a tree. Just a tree. Cast that into the waters, and the waters went from being bitter to sweet. Great. Got water. All is right with the world. And it says this. This is also kind of interesting, and I think it's key here how all of these pieces fit together. One of the things that I notice when I try to put together the teaching and pull out some of the themes and say, okay, what are some things that really apply today and so forth, is there are so many themes, so many elements to these crafted incidents in history where the gears just mesh. And you say, this element appears out of nowhere, but it's going to make an important point later on. It's really hard to sort these themes out without realizing how they all come together. And indeed, that's part of the minimum necessary miracle too. Because what does it say here? They've just finished whining. They have this tree cast in the waters. The waters go from bitter, marah, to sweet. They drink. And there it says he made for them two things. A hook and a mishpat. Hook and a mirror. What's that? Okay, well, statutes, judgments, and commandments, right? We know these words. Okay, statute. That's a kind of a law, an element of law, statute in this case, which it's generally said, if it's called a hook, it means do it because I say so. Do it because you don't really understand. It's not easy to prove why this is important. Just trust me, believe me, it is. And the most famous example, the one that the sages will always point to when you say, what's a hook? Answer, the story, the hook, the statute of the red heifer. It's the one that Solomon famously said, you know, I'm a pretty wise dude. I don't have a clue what's going on with this particular hook. This one just kind of baffles me. Well, maybe we see later on that there are elements to the hook. No, it's not a perfect analogy, and that's kind of the beauty of it. But there are elements of the hook of the red heifer. What does the red heifer do? It makes clean things unclean, makes unclean things clean. How do it do that? That's a hook, man. It's kind of amazing. But at least it helps us to understand what it is that we don't understand, and that sometimes we just have to wait and see, be still and know that I am Yah. When the whole story is told, maybe it'll be a bit more clear. But in this case, there's another element of this that's also important. It's got to keep coming back as the gears mesh in our story, and that is that he makes these at least two things, a statute and an ordinance, and there he tested them. We're not told explicitly at this point what the statute and the ordinance are, but the scholars, and I will go with them in this case, will point to this mishpat that is made and say, well, that's got to do with Sabbath. Why do we know that? Well, because in just about a chapter, we're going to be told about the Sabbath, and he's going to say, hey, I already told you about this. This is something about which Yahuwah has already, past tense, spoken. Now you're going to go through the seventh day Sabbath. You're going to see it play out. So it makes sense. In other words, right here in the very same Parsha, we're seeing, there's a pretty good case to be made the Sabbath is the ordinance that's being talked about there. Well, what does he say about him? He says, if you will diligently shema, hearken, shamar, right? Depends on the the conjugation of the word. But if you'll hear and obey the voice of Yahuwah Eloheka, and you'll do that which is right in his eyes, and give ear to, right, what? His commandments, and keep all of his statutes, his hukin, then I will put none of the diseases upon you, which I've already put, you've seen them, upon the Egyptians. Remember the boils and a lot of the nasty stuff? Because, we've heard this before. Ki ani Yahuwah. But wait. Not just ki ani Yahuwah, a specific attribute is going to be described in this case. This is what sometimes you'll see referred to as one of the names of Yah. Yahuwah Rapha. I am Yahuwah that heals you. Yahuwah the healer. And in this case, it's Rofeka. I hope I'm pronouncing that pretty much right. My Hebrew accent leaves a bit to be desired. But remember, the root word gets conjugated, because basically what he's saying here is, I'm the one that heals y'all. All of you. So we've got now what? We've got two of the elements of the human condition, the whining. We see the first one, take the long way home, going to get folks trapped. Well, it's making the larger point. Ki ani Yahuwah. The Egyptians will know that I am who I say I am. It'll be the last thing they figure out. He is, in fact, demonstrating. He is a master of war. You all will see it intimately, firsthand. You will know. Right thing to do. Fear not. Stand still. Watch. See. The Yeshuat Yahuwah, and they did. Then we got more whining at the place called Marah of bitter waters. And we head on down the road. They took their journey from this place of the palm trees and water, 12 springs. They headed to the wilderness of Sin. They get there on the 15th day of the second month, kind of the second Passover, after they have departed out of Mitzrayim. And one more time, the coal Idat, the whole congregation of B'nai Israel, begins to whine, murmur, groan. There's some other words you could use. They're not even as kind as whine, but you get the idea. Against Moshe and against Aaron in the wilderness. Children of Israel said the following. I wish we had died. Why didn't we die by the hand of Yahuwah in Egypt? We sat by the flesh pots. We had all kinds of good stuff. We got good bread. Why'd you bring us out here into this nasty wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger? All right, says Yahuwah to Moshe, I will cause bread, lechem, literally to rain down from you, for you, from the heavens. People are going to go out. They're going to gather a whole portion every single day. so that I can test them. I'm going to see whether they will walk in my Torah or not. Now, interesting here. Here's another reference to the cycles. I think this line is still as apropos as it ever was. I'm going to rain things down on them. I'm going to see one simple thing, whether they will walk in my Torah, my instruction, or not. Answer, well, you know, sometimes they do for a little while. Mostly they don't. That's been true then. It was true as the land was divided. It was true as both northern and southern kingdoms were sent into exile. Not the only time. We're still, most of us, especially of the lost tribes, still in exile, scattered exactly as he told we would be. And we're still getting tested. Will we or will we not walk in his Torah or not? Are we going out or are we coming in? Well, human condition at least is constant. The whining seems to be as well. Here we get this reference that I've already talked about, the gears mesh, to the Sabbath. It'll come to pass on the sixth day. Sixth day, they prepare that which they bring in. They're going to get twice as much because it's going to last for 2 days. And Moshe and Aaron tell the children of Israel what they're going to do. You're going to know, you will know that Yahuwah brought you out of the land of bondage, out of Mitzrayim. You're going to see the glory of Yahuwah. He has heard your whining, your murmuring, your groaning, your moaning. Who are you? And more importantly, who are we that you would murmur against us? This is Moshe and Aaron speaking. This shall be, when Yahuwah gives you in the morning some flesh to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, and he hears your murmurings, you'll realize you're not, in fact, murmuring just against us, or even at us at all, but in fact against him, against Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Come on, he's heard you. And indeed, that's what it says, next verse 11. Yahuwah says to Moshe, I've heard this whining, this murmuring of these children of Israel. Speak to them, tell them, at dusk you'll eat flesh. In the morning you're going to get all the bread you need. You shall know that Ani Yahuwah Eloheka. In this case, it's Elohekim, because this is plural. This is plural. The progression here, Egyptians know. You all saw it. You should know, but we're evidently not done yet. One more time, and this time it's the Hebrew familiar plural form, the y'all form. Y'all shall know, ki ani Yahuwah Elohekim. Your God, plural. Quails come up. There's dew. They see this stuff on the ground. It's kind of shiny, scale-like thing like hoarfrost. What is that? They say. Man. Man. What is that? Ma. Ma, nah. There's another one of those words that's really kind of neat. Everybody's heard they ate manna in the wilderness, but we don't realize that the word literally means, what's that? They ate, what is that, in the wilderness for 40 years. Well, that's the lechem. That's the kind of bread that Yahuwah told them. Moshe said, Yahuwah has given you to eat. Get it. Gather it up. Tells them how much is going to happen. He tells them if they try to keep it overnight, it's going to get nasty and wormy and rot. And indeed, some of them test it. Yeah, it does. Then he says, on the sixth day, tomorrow is a solemn rest, Sabbath day. And remember, you've already been told about this. This is the hearkening back part. This is, I believe, the thing about which they were just told not too long ago. That commandment, that mishpat that they were given. It's about Sabbath. Bake what you need to bake, seethe what you need to seethe, and lay it up. It will last this time. No worms, because it's the Sabbath day. Eat today. Today is a Sabbath. You're not going to go out and find any. If you try, you're not going to get any. Sure enough, there wasn't. Some of them did, though. Some of them tried anyway. Moshe says, how long? And he doesn't say it of himself. He says it because he is asked the question by his superior. How long are you going to refuse to keep my mitzvoti, and my Torah-ti, my instructions? Well, finally, they get the message. They rest on the Sabbath day. They call the name of the place after the name of the thing that they didn't know what it was. What's that? The place was called manna. The name of the thing was called manna. Going to put some of that in the ark of testimony eventually and keep it for future generations so they too will know. What is it? Why is it? And more importantly, ki ani Yahuwah. Which takes us almost, but not quite, to the end of the portion, chapter 17, where guess what? We've still got one more bit of whining to go. Congregation, Kol Edot, journeyed in this wilderness of sin. They came to a place, they camped there, called Rephidim. Guess what? No water there either. They strove with Moshe. Give us water! Why are you striving with me? Why do you test? Why do you try Yahuwah? Oh, they got thirsty. They whined some more. They whined against Moshe, right? Say it with me, folks. We could almost, this would be called the Song of the Whiners, maybe. And they sang the song of whining. Therefore, why have you brought us up out of Mitzrayim to kill us and all of our children with thirst? What am I going to do with these people? Says Moshe. He's almost whining. They're about ready to stone me. All right. Go on before the people. Get yourself some elders. Get your rod. Remember that rod you smote the river Nile with? Take it in your hand and go. Here's what's going to happen. Now, this is a really key understanding. This is also one of these places that is going to have, let's just say, cyclical reappearances. And if we don't understand the cycles and the commandment that's given for where we are in the cycle, here is a real, real lesson. Sometimes you hit the rock, other times you don't. You better pay attention to where you are in the cycle. First time around, there's a rock in Horeb. You smite that one. Got it, Moshe? Water's going to come out. People will drink. Moshe did so. All the elders were checking it out. They were watching. And indeed, out comes the water. The name of the place was called Massah and Meribah because two things. Of the striving of the children of Israel, the B'nai Israel, they were striving. And because they tested him. They tested his patience. Now, at this point, I'm going to pause, and I'm going to look at some of these words and phrases in some detail, because I'm going to contend that when it comes to everything we've been working up in this portion, to this idea of are we coming in or are we going out, the human condition, the whining, the fact that we're seeing Ki Ani Yahuwah, that he is going to give statutes and commandments and instruction in more general sense, fear not, stand still, see and know the salvation. And where does that bring us to? The rock. The rock gets smitten. You could almost say living water comes out of it, right? The people drink. Place gets a name because of the striving of the children and because they tested him. Now, what's the key here? I'm going to suggest that this next sentence is really, really interesting. Is Yahuwah among us or not? Think about that a second. Is Yahuwah among us or not? Now, part of me wants to say, for crying out loud, what are we talking? Of course he is. See that pillar of fire by day and of by night and of cloud by day? Haven't you been paying attention? Haven't you seen the entire sequence of incidents and miracles and messages here? Haven't you seen these gears meshing? Well, it's a lot easier to see them when you got 1,000 years of hindsight to look back on sometimes. Especially if somebody goes to all the nice trouble of writing it down for you, and scholars and sages have had a chance to point out connections that most of us miss the first 20 or so times we read through it. But the question is key. And of course, I'm going to suggest what's really interesting about this question is, hey, when it comes to cycles, this is another question. Relates to the human condition, and it relates to where we are, and indeed it relates to what's going on today. Is Yahuwah among us or not? We got a lot of folks that are trying to say, oh, we're going to bring in this fake god. Allah, the moon god. Molech, we offer sacrifices to Ishtar. You got a god, we got a place for her. Mostly it's in Hollywood. We're worshiping all these fake gods. We got lots of fake gods that look in the mirror and think they're gods in Washington and on Madison Avenue and other places too. The key, though, is Yahuwah among us or not? Well, as far as most of the modern American world is concerned, we got rid of him a long time ago. God is dead, said Nietzsche. He hasn't been welcome in the public school since the early 1960s. He's not welcome in the White House, at least he wasn't for sure when the jihadist in chief was in there. Is Yahuwah among us or not? That is going to be asked, of course, at a later date, famously as well. It's also the connection of these three verses that I'm going to point to. And you've heard me refer to this. I mentioned this term last night. It's one of these Missouri terms. I don't know. We got it, I think, from the cartoon. There was a famous cartoon with the Tasmanian devil. What was that? Was that Roadrunner? I don't remember. It was one of those Hanna-Barbera cartoons anyway. This Tasmanian devil would come and he'd spin around and he was always just causing havoc. But basically when he would show up, you get the thing that I have come to refer to as the Tasmanian downshift. Where the heck did that came from? Something comes out of left field. Does not appear to be related at all. You ever seen some TV shows? We were watching one the other day where people are driving along innocently and all of a sudden here comes this truck out of nowhere, T-bones them. Whoa! Where'd that come from? Well, that's kind of what happens here. People are striving. We got this rock. The rock is smitten. Water comes out. They drink. But because they are striving, they ask this question, is Yahuwah among us or not? And what's the next thing that happens? Right out of left field, then comes Amalek. Now, Amalek, if you know anything about the Bible, is one of the real villains, right? You got Batman, and he's got the Joker, and Catwoman, and all these famous villains. Superman has Lex Luthor. The Bible has Amalek. We got some others too, but it comes to when it comes to chief villains, Amalek is right there at the top of the list. Matter of fact, we're going to get some pretty good indication in this one. Yahuwah will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Amalek is a nasty set of villains. Well, they fought with Israel in this place, Rephidim, that we've already been talking about. We know the story. The story is interesting. Moshe goes and sends out Joshua to fight. He sends folks out to do battle. And while he is doing that, got Aaron and Hur, his right-hand and left-hand man, literally, go up to the top of the hill where the general watches over the battle. Moshe takes his rod, his hand, and he holds this up. And when he holds up his hand, Israel prevailed. But when he let down his hand, Amalek prevails. Well, got to hold up his hands, and that's tough. Have you ever tried to do it for hour after hour after hour? So the idea is, you can picture this, Aaron and Hur lifted up his hands, one on one side, one on the other, till the sun went down. And the whole time that's happening, Joshua, well, kicked butt and took names. He discomfited Amalek. He killed him with the edge of the sword. But it's the connection that I think is fascinating about this. Got people striving. They have seen another miracle. The rock has been held up. Water comes out of it. They live. But because they strive, it would seem, right? Can I prove that? Well, no. It's just that the connection is right there. They strive. Is Yahuwah among us or not? Bang! Here comes Amalek. Write this, Moshe is told, in the words in red. Put this in the book for a memorial. Rehearse it. Make sure Joshua remembers it. He will. He was there. But I want to make sure. Other people later, they're going to remember this too. I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Well, wait a minute. That hadn't happened yet. Hey, cycles upon cycles, the human condition going out or coming in. We still got to deal with Amalek. How do we know that? Well, he's going to eventually blot it out, but it hadn't happened yet because we find at the end of the portion, Yahuwah will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Presumably, and I'm going to suggest, yep, we can see that. It's still happening. Gates are being held open. We got judges saying, come on, Amalek, come on in. You can now kick some butt and take some names. Your people have forgotten Yahuwah anyway. They don't like him. They'd rather have all these other fake gods, the same ones that Amalek and the others in Canaan worshipped. Are we going out or are we coming in? Headed towards bondage or away from bondage? Who's going out? Who's coming in? And what the hell is going on as we look at the world today? Well, I'll tell you one thing. Amalek is still out there, and we're still dealing with Amalek. And Amalek, at this point, seems to be prevailing. Why? Because verse 15 already tells us. Moshe built an altar. He called the name of it Yahuwah Nisi. My banner. Another one of the names. Two of the famous names of Yah appear in this very Torah portion. Yahuwah Rapha. Now Yahuwah Nisi, my banner. A standard, something that is lifted up. Guess what? When the hands aren't up, when his standard, his banner is not lifted up, Amalek prevails. Gee, do you think there's a moral for us there? What I'm going to do next is move on. We're going to connect some more dots. We're going to take a focus on a couple different areas, including something that is, I think, correctly connected with this one from the Brit Hadashah. As a matter of fact, it's one of my favorites in the whole set of apostolic writings, and it really does fit here. It kind of fits anywhere, but it especially fits today because of this concept of is Yahuwah among us or not? How will we know? Well, if we don't know him, if we don't know his character, if we miss the whole point of Ani Yahuwah, if we think his word isn't worth keeping, that he isn't among us, then we don't care what he said anyway. It's all done away with. It's nailed to the cross by a guy whose name we don't really even know, because we forget the whole point of Yahshua saves. The salvation of Yah. That's exactly what this book Shemot is about, along with Ani Yahuwah. What's his character? His character is he is the one who does that. Is he among us or not? Well, if you have to ask the question, you're missing the point. But it does say he will have war with Amalek from generation to generation, to which I say, yep, and here we are. So I want to point to again some of the things that are going on. Let's talk a little bit about what's in the news and what are we hearing. Of course, this week it would seem that the one thing that the satanically inclined waste stream news media wants to focus on is how dare this upstart that we would prefer to be dead anyway in the White House think that he can do the exact kind of same things and wield the imperial pen like all of the tyrants who came before him. How dare he think that? Well, he doesn't serve our God. Doesn't that kind of help clarify it? Make it a little bit more simple? We're trying to bring in the people who hate this God. We have basically said for years, right, the Declaration of Independence isn't taught in schools anymore. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator, who? Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh! Yeah, that one, the one that wrote the book. Is his name in the Declaration of Independence? No, but three different attributes are, plus he is called the Creator. Isaiah 33. I, Yahuwah, am your king, I'm your judge, I'm your lawgiver. And if you look at the Declaration, it's easy to spot. You'll see four specific references. First one, the Creator, obviously. And then we've got king, judge, lawgiver. Supreme judge of the world, divine providence, and so forth. What's the point? The point is we don't like that God anymore. We once agreed unanimously that there were certain principles upon which the law of these United States was based, that there is a God, that he's given us rights, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Why do we consent? Because he's the real God. And we recognize that no government of mere men on earth has the authority to override what he says, to say this is not law anymore. Thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal. Well, if a majority of people in a democracy say it's okay to steal, yeah, have at it. If they want to steal your life, they want to rape your wife, you got it, go for it, man. If they want to say we don't like your God, we're not going to keep his Sabbath, we're going to blaspheme his name, we're going to drag him through the mud, and we're going to eventually open the gates and bring in all kinds of people who will help us to overrun you. Come on, Amalek, welcome in. Well, then it's no longer unanimous, is it? And we don't allow his name to be taught or his word to be taught or the things that he says keep, do forever to be taught. Whether we're talking about honest weights and measures, we got rid of that 100 years ago. We put the final nail in the coffin in August of 1971. Or whether we're talking about something as simple as what constitutes a marriage. If God says it's okay, they say we don't like it. But if he says, on the other hand, something is an abomination, like in a man lying with a man as with a woman, well, we'll license that, we'll mandate that. And if you want to do business, you'd better like it. And if you don't like it, well, we'll show you. We'll bring in a whole lot of other people who will essentially overrun you and the God that you came in with. A lot of whining? Then comes Amalek. Isn't that interesting? Where are we in the cycle, right? We're going out or coming in? What we are is we're in, and now we've got other people, Amalek, coming in, and basically making sure that, no, the cycle is not moving away from bondage. It is, so far as, those minions of Satan who walk in men's shoes, if you want to put it that way, are concerned, bondage is coming. That brings me to this, right? We talked about this last week. It is a line, it's a verse that you'll hear a lot of times. What got me thinking about this week was I heard any number of stories, so-called evangelical extrans. Extrans. These are Christians that have gotten rid of the whole concept of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. They put an X in there. Anybody but him. Jesus did away with the law. Well, excuse me, then whatever he is, he sure as hell ain't the Mashiach whose coming was foretold, the prophet like unto Moshe, the one who, and we'll talk about this in a minute, said he wasn't going to change not the tiniest part, not one yod nor tittle of his own instruction, so long as heaven and earth still existed. We're talking about another Jesus, whom we have not preached, clearly. So we had 500 of these extran fakers. Oh, gee, Mark, you're being kind of tough on them. You're damn right I am. On purpose. Because these people are liars and the truth is not in them. They're preaching another Jesus. Shaul, Paul said, let him be accursed. I'll say it again. Let him be accursed. Yeshua says it. He says, you got somebody that claims to be a teacher and he's teaching that even the least of these commandments are done away with? Well, if he repents, and they took that out, then he'll be called least if he makes it into the kingdom of heaven. Oh, no, it doesn't say that, Mark. Well, excuse me. Guess who rewrote it? Guess why it is that so much of the things that he said have been twisted? If there's a straight gate and a narrow way and few there be that find it? You think maybe 500 so-called preachers of another Jesus who deliberately distort it, who twist Paul, like the unlearned and untaught that 2 Peter 3:15 and 16 warns us about? You think maybe we've inherited lies from our fathers, in other words? You're darn right. Anyway, these 500 so-called extrans wrote a letter to Trump. And they basically twisted the hell out of Scripture and said, oh, here's what we got to do. We got to bring in more of Amalek, more of the Allah worshipers, more in short of anybody who literally stands against everything that the God of the Bible says to do. They'll tell us Allah is greater. Why am I mentioning this? Well, because last week we saw it once. It appears any number of places in Scripture, almost word for word. Last week, Exodus 12:49 was in the portion. It says, one law, one Torah, really. It's one instruction for you, the homeborn, those who are born in the place, and for the stranger that sojourns among you. Well, what's that got to do with anything, Mark? One Torah, one law, one instruction for you, the homeborn, and for the stranger that sojourns among you. Isn't that the point? Isn't that what the Declaration of Independence was saying? We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created what? Equal under the law. That's what they're referring to. It's poetic license. But we're talking about this concept of justice, not just us. That's what we've had. One Torah, one instruction, one law for the homeborn and for the stranger. Well, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that why it's okay to bring in these people? I ask you a question. This I have referred to as self-selection. Write that down. We'll come back to it. Self-selection. What does that mean? Harken back with me, if you will, to the founding era when you had people all over Europe, Northern Europe, Scandinavia, Brits, Germans, coming in waves, different folks at different times, but basically they had one thing in common. They were being persecuted for their belief in the God of the Bible. You have the Pilgrims. You've got the Quakers. You've got some of the Lutherans. You've got all kinds of folks. Now, they may have had little different understandings. Yes, a few of them were Sabbath keepers. A lot of them had already bought into elements of the lie. But they were being persecuted. You can look at William Penn. You can look at some of the folks that came. What was the key? Again, those who were coming out, those who were being shellacked out of Europe were looking for a place where they could worship God in truth. Even if they had some different concepts, they came here. And they did. And they basically came together, unanimously agreeing on certain things. In the 18th century, about, 1776, they said, we may have some different understandings. One thing we can agree on, there is one creator. He is our king. He is our judge. He is our lawgiver. And there are certain things that we, will not tolerate. They wrote that later down as the Bill of Rights. We don't want any government of men saying that they can't do that. Oh, wait a minute, Mark. That's what the Islamics are coming to do. They're coming to worship God. Well, excuse me. This is the key thing that must not be overlooked. They're not worshiping the same God, folks. Quakers, Pilgrims, Lutherans, Congregationalists, Methodists, Presbyterians. They understood that their book, their scriptures, even if they misread it, I don't doubt that. I would say I had some differences. Now, arguably, I had a lot less differences with any of the churched folks of those times, Sabbath notwithstanding, than I would with the vast majority of most of the churched folks today. Because we've come a hell of a long ways in the wrong direction since then, not the right direction. They, for example, knew better than to take the mark of the state corporate church. All right, back to the point here. What are we talking about today? We're not talking about one of the 12 tribes of Israel. We're not talking about people who want to be grafted in. We're not talking about people who yearn to breathe free, who self-select coming to this land because it's a place where the God of the Bible and His Word is held up, Yahuwah Nisi, as a standard. And which, based on His instruction, the key elements that they all agreed on, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill. No, we don't agree on that anymore. We got a democracy here now. Why is Amalek wanting to come in? What's the point? Because it's a whole different God. Amalek, the Creator says, I will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. We're talking about people who are now being invited in. The self-selection, once upon a time, it was about freedom, it was about liberty, it was about worshiping Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, even if we got the name wrong. Now the self-selection is, hey, come on and get the goodies. You don't have to be part of the melting pot. You don't have to be absorbed. You don't have to accept the culture, the law of the land. You can bring your Sharia with you. Now, the problem is this. This is what I call the logical non sequitur. It's the disconnect. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. I'm going to ask it bluntly. Were they talking about Islam? The answer? Hell no. Adams and Jefferson, you can go read the history of the war with the Barbary pirates, and when they met with a mufti, one of the Islamic leaders of the day, and literally were shocked. Adams made an interesting comment. I don't have the quote sitting here in front of me. Basically, he said, we're going to have war with these folks from generation to generation. Why? Because Islam is not about the God of the Bible. Anybody that's read both books, and there aren't that many anymore, knows that darned well. You could say the same thing about Molech, about Baal, about the gods of Canaan. Whether they later had Greek names or Roman names or Norse names, they are not. Nothing about them is the same. The Greek gods, the Roman gods, the Norse gods, they were capricious. They were fickle. They liked just to mess with people. Read the stories. They were not trustworthy. They did not deliver people from bondage so that the message would go down through the generations. Ani Yahuwah. We're talking about whole different gods. Now, I use the example this way. If you want to ask the question, hey, during the time of the Americas, there were some tribes, some peoples down further south, Central South America. There were Mayans, there were Incans, there were Aztecs. They had some things in common. They were pagans. I asked this last night. Nobody gave me the answer, and I should have remembered to look it up. I didn't. A Mel Gibson movie about that period of time, about the shows some pretty graphic scenes, essentially. I just think it's the scenes that are invaluable at making this point. But you've probably heard the stories of how the Aztecs did it. Cortez and some of the others, oh, those were mean Spanish conquistadors. They wanted the gold. Well, they were also horrified at the paganism that they saw. Again, I would have some religious, biblical, scriptural differences with those folks. One thing I don't differ from them on is they saw the human sacrifices up on top of those pyramids, people having their hearts cut out of their chests while they were still alive and breathing and held up in bloody glory as people screamed, yeah! And then they wanted to eat the flesh. I would say that's pretty sick. Now, here's the question. Well, they have a right to their religion. Let me put it in the personal vernacular. Somebody moves in next door to me and they say, you know what? I think I might want to sacrifice your wife to my God. Click. Ka-chunk. The shotgun. You hear that sound? You try it, buddy. I'll blow your head all over this wall. There comes a point that we have to realize certain religious beliefs are just plain incompatible. Islam is about submission. There is peace. Yeah, it's a religion of peace. It's the peace of the grave. It's the peace that says submit or die. Off with his head. The point at which Thomas Jefferson, a great fan of religious freedom and an enemy of any form of tyranny over the mind of men, said, you know what? Islam is a form of tyranny over the mind of man. It is incompatible with the law as we know it. From the Creator. Indeed, I fear for my country when I tremble. I tremble for my country when I realize that God is just and His justice cannot sleep forever, said the same guy. Folks, the problem is this. James says, as I've quoted this several times in the last few weeks, Yaakov 1. The double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. You know what else? He better not think he's going to get anything from God. You cannot claim to be a fan of religious freedom and a fan of Islam because they are utterly incompatible. You cannot claim to be a servant of the Most High, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and then turn right around and say, Allahu Akbar, Allah's greater than that God. Somebody is lying somewhere. And we got these 500 blithering idiots. No, they're not stupid, folks. They're liars, and the truth is not in them. Because they've been lying about Jesus, saying he did away with the law for a long time. No wonder they're basically saying, come on in. Yeah, we love any other God. Aren't we fans of Ishtar? Don't we celebrate the little bunnies and eggs? Don't we do all of these things that if we actually read the book that we claim to believe in, tells us in no uncertain terms that this stuff is an abomination to him? Doesn't he say that the double-minded man, not only is he unstable in all his ways, he better not think he's going to get anything from God? There's a huge disconnect here, and that's the lesson. Now, here is where I want to go next. This is a story, makes the point. I'll go into this more detail later. We'll play some recordings this afternoon. But I saw a piece from the Rutherford Institute founder and president, John W. Whitehead. This guy is pretty well known among libertarian circles. I like reading Whitehead's work. He has a historical piece about one of the more satanic organizations. You've heard of the three letters, Federal Bureau of Instigation. I refer to James Comey, the head of that particularly, I would say nowadays discredited group, as the Whoremeister, the Madam. Why? Because Comey basically got the word from his boss, Loretta Lynch Mob, right there on the tarmac. Metaphorically, the horse's head in the bed. I made him an offer he couldn't refuse. And he dropped it. The ball, that is, when it came to prosecuting one of the most satanically evil, witchy women, murderesses, and treason mongers. Did I say all of that right? Yeah, Hillary Clinton. Puts her hand on the Bible, and everybody knows she is lying through her teeth. Because there's nothing about that document, the Constitution, that she cares about, or the God that's in that book. How do I know that? By her fruit. It's been obvious. Well, Comey, at least, couldn't see the fruit. Comey admitted, we're not going to prosecute her. There may be tens of thousands of emails that we took lesser people and put them in jail for, took away their pensions, booted them out in disgrace. From generals to midshipmen for doing far less. But hey, if you want to commit treason, do it in style. Right? It's the old joke about the bankster. You borrow $1,000, you can't pay it back, you're in trouble. But if you borrow $1 billion, you own the bank. Well, Hitler owns the FBI, and they still do. We got a federal judge, unelected, this last week, exceeded his authority, his jurisdiction. He took his almighty pen and said, I could care less about the law. Trump is operating in accord with a law that's pretty clear. It's the 1952, is it McCarran? Let's see what the name of the act is. Anyway, 1952 act that basically gives the president pretty well carte blanche with his imperial pen to affect immigration in no uncertain terms. The judge can't read the law clearly, and he overrides it, saying, how dare you say no to the immigrants that we want to come in and destroy the rule of law. McCarran-Walter Act of 1952. It's also called the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952, Chapter 12, U.S. Code 8. And here's what the none other than the Los Angeles Times said. Fortunately for Trump, quote, the law on immigration and related matters favors the president. Oh, you don't say. Legal precedents have traditionally accorded the chief executive complete and nearly unchecked power to deny foreigners permission to enter the United States. But basically the rest of the article says we don't really like this guy. We don't want him to do what Obama and before him Carter did almost precisely. Why is this important? Here's the compare the contrast. Here's the double think, the double-mindedness revealed. Back to the story I started into with John W. Whitehead. It's called FBI. Ah, there you go. That's why I mentioned all of the jazz about the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The silent terror of the Fourth Reich. Okay, we've already said this. Given what I've seen out of the FBI, I'll admit, I'm not a big fan of the Hormeister. And I'm not a particularly big fan of an agency that claims to be out there looking for terrorists when, in fact, if they just look in the mirror, they'd find plenty. You look at most of the false flag events of the last few years. There's an FBI agent or an informant in there somewhere. You look at the people who were claimed to be lone wolf terrorists. But in general, they did have handlers. And in general, the other thing that you're going to not find is the videotapes. Whether we're talking about Orlando or San Bernardino or, for crying out loud, Sandy Hook or any number of other places. Oh, were those judges appointed by Obama? No, one of them was appointed by the other communist in the White House. I think it was George W. Bush, the three-judge panel, if you're asking about the Ninth Circus. The first guy, I forget who the first guy was, but they're all leftists. Doesn't matter who appointed them. You know, basically, look at some of the so-called Republicans, from the Speaker of the House to the leader of the Senate, to, for crying out loud, John McCain and others who are just as guilty of treason as some of the worst on the other side. The point is, people have learned to put their hand on the Bible and lie. They swear to support a document that they have absolutely no intention of supporting, and more importantly, they hate, by their fruit, they hate the God who gave us liberty and gave us life. Here's the story with Whitehead. And some of you have heard this. I'll do it quickly because I want to get to the punchline here. After World War II, there were a whole lot of perfectly good Nazis and a whole lot of perfectly good information, like Joseph Mengele's wonderful medical, quote-unquote, data, obtained by killing, torturing, and murdering a whole lot of people, including a lot of young Jewish twins and so forth. Well, it just wouldn't do for all that wonderful data and information to go to waste now, would it? So what did the U.S. do? Well, most famously, they brought high-profile Nazis like Wernher von Braun to the United States. But they got a lot of others, too. And they, in fact, got things that became Project MK Ultra, mind control, drugs, Timothy Leary, you know the names, LSD. We have ways of controlling people and making them obey. And that's just the start of it. In the years following the Second World War, writes Whitehead, and he quotes a couple of books, one of them by historian Robert Gellately. They recruited Hitler's employees, his high-ranking Nazis, his low-ranking Nazis, his engineers. They embraced Hitler's protocols. they adopted his mindset concerning law and order, his tactics, incrementally. And they began to lay the foundation for the rise of what we've seen now for the last few years, the Fourth Reich. It's all well documented. It turns out that J. Edgar Hoover, when he was head of the FBI, actually sent one of his high-ranking right-hand men, Edmund Patrick Coffey, to Berlin at the invitation of the German Gestapo in January of 1938 to check out how it is that this wonderful Nazi organization could be so bloodily, ruthlessly efficient. Und wir might be able to learn something! The FBI was so impressed, writes the historian, with the Nazi regime, that, and here he quotes the New York Times. In the decades after World War II, the FBI, along with other government agencies, aggressively recruited, are you sitting down, at least 1,000 Nazis, migrants. I don't know, are we talking Amalek? No, they're just people who didn't necessarily share that same understanding about truth, justice, and the American way. By their fruit, you could argue. And it included some of Hitler's highest henchmen. One of them was the head of a Nazi concentration camp, among others. They were given secret visas. They were brought to America. And you know the name, I hope. It's called Project Paperclip. They were hired by various agencies. They acted as spies, informants. They were camouflaged to ensure that their true identities and Nazi past and the Holocaust would remain unknown. Now, here's the kicker. Here comes the doublethink. This is the line in the paragraph that I hope will have people literally wanting to, well, practically throw up. While Nazis were being brought in by the thousands, Jewish refugees, these were people who were victims of Hitler's regime and his blitzkrieg across Europe. They were refused entry visas because, you know, national security. Are you getting this? The same lying, blankety-blanking idiots. No, they're not idiots. They're evil. Who are wailing today, whining, we gotta bring in more terrorists. Oh, these poor people, they're immigrants. There's no legal precedent for not letting them in. The hell there's not. While they were bringing in Nazis by the thousand, they were refusing Bible-believing Jews by the thousand. Because of national, you talk about a lie. Oh, it's okay to bring in Nazis for national security reasons? Achtung, we will know how to crack down and make national security something the Fourth Reich would be proud of. And then you wonder what happened to the rule of law. We wonder how we managed to slide so far from we hold these truths to be self-evident. And we wonder why, if the Nazis weren't enough, why, let's bring ourselves in some head-whacking, Allah-pushing, Islamic submission experts. We got the submission experts that already, via Operation Paperclip, have showed the three-letter federal agencies how to ruthlessly make darn sure that the things that need to happen, happen. You wonder why it is we've got judges that cave? I suspect that the same reason we had judges caving is because we had an FBI head that caved, like we had Loretta Lynch mob that caved. I'm thankful that it would seem that as Trump tries to do some things that seem on the right side of the biblical understanding, there are certainly other things I don't agree with at all. Got to make that point clear. But as all of this goes on, folks, one thing is really clear. I will have war with Amalek from generation to generation, and we're seeing it. But the very idea, the doublethink, we will let people in who hate the God of the Bible and say, Allahu Akbar, you will submit or die. Your law will change. And don't kid yourself. The idea of Sharia law is submission. There is nothing about it that is consistent with the Torah or the one God of Scripture. The reason why Allahu Akbar is the clarion cry is because it means, literally, the moon god is greater. Greater than who? Well, any, but especially Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Can we see why Yahuwah will have war with Amalek from generation to generation? Where are we in the cycle? Going out or coming in? Well, the people that are coming in are not here to provide greater freedom. They're not here to strengthen the rule of law. They're not here to strengthen the understanding of what this nation was once upon a time founded upon. What they're here to do is exactly what happened in Canaan, to bring in the fake gods, to bring in a totalitarian regime. It's exactly a process that, guess what, isn't new. It's been going on at least since the late 1940s. And the whole concept that it's anything else is doublethink. In other words, it's double-minded. And guess what? James says it. That kind of man should not expect anything from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. This piece came out yesterday. The major media, the waste stream, now he says they missed it. This is from WorldNet Daily. I don't think they missed it. I think they're explicitly ignoring the elephant in the room. Without mentioning Islam, the executive order that came out basically said the following, and listen to this. This is, again, quoted verbatim from the executive order, that the servants of Satan who walk in men's shoes are making darn sure will not be permitted. Right? It's okay. See, Obama can wield the executive order pen. He can kill you. Remember, he signed NDAA at midnight on New Year's Eve, 2011. Says we can kill you without due process. We don't need no stinking warrant. We don't even need evidence. That's not unconstitutional. That's not a problem. A little murder? Well, if the emperor says thumbs up, well, you know, people die. Can we not see the incredible disconnect here? Well, here's another example. The order that was so nasty that Hollywood hates it, and the so-called judges in these formerly free United States will not tolerate. They went where? To the Ninth Circus. The most evil, the most insidiously stupid cases of fruits and nuts that we have. Everybody, it's called the Ninth Circus for a reason. The order says this: in order to protect Americans, the United States must ensure that those admitted to this country do not bear hostile attitudes towards it and its founding principles. The United States cannot and should not admit those who do not support the Constitution or those who would place violent ideologies over American law. And it goes on. But there is a really interesting key there. Now, notice it does not say Islam, but it's clear, and this is the elephant in the room. Nobody who reads this says, well, they're talking about Islam. Why are they talking about Islam? Because they said the words, those who would place violent ideologies over American law. In other words, those who explicitly make no bones about it. Did you watch the idiot women marching a couple weeks ago? They were putting on burqas, talking about freedom, while all the time saying openly their leadership, we're here to push Sharia. What's Sharia going to do besides mutilating women's genitalia, all in the name of greater freedom and submission? Double-mindedness. Weakness is strength. War is peace. Islam is a religion of peace. Well, it is, but it's the peace of the grave. In other words, what's the big lie? Here is how one of the analysts says the executive order should be read. And this, of course, is the reason why they are squealing like stuck pigs. Quote, the Trump administration is going to treat Islam as a hostile political ideology. This is what has been needed. This analyst, his name's Thomas, suggests, for several decades. It is the very reversal of this Islam is a religion of peace doctrine set in place by Bush in September 17, 2001. And the problem is, it does indeed strike terror into the hearts of anyone who would try to promote Sharia, Islamic law, above the existing supreme law of these United States. Yeah, the Constitution, and in particular, let's not kid ourselves, Allahu Akbar is about as antithetical to Ani Yahuwah Eloheka as any other Molech or Baal or fake god that we've seen. The battle lines are drawn. And it's not coincidental, of course, that we're talking about organizations here that are literally modeled after the Nazi regime and seeking to put a Fourth Reich in place. Here's another story earlier. This was actually last week. I probably mentioned it. Trump has put radical Islamic extremism in the crosshairs. Remember, the jihadist in chief prior to this wouldn't even say the words, would not allow the words. The press wouldn't say them. Muslim or Islam in the same sentence with terror. They had a bogus program called Countering Violent Extremism. Who was it directed at? Sovereign citizens, gun nuts, people who hold gold and hoard food, people in short that think the Constitution still means a damn in the United States. The problem is, as this story puts it, Trump has put radical Islamic extremism in the crosshair and taken the bullseye off of people that were once called American patriots, constitutionalists, supporters of the rule of law, and oh, God forbid, readers of the Bible. There's a lot more that could be said on this, and that's not the point. What I want to do is just draw the connection. Keep coming back to this concept. Are we going out, shellacked? Are we being sent out? Or are we coming in? The human condition, the whining, continues. People are whining wherever they are for whatever reasons. There's always good reasons to whine. But the related question, when it comes to the cycles, is human freedom increasing? Those whom he has made free are free indeed, it says somewhere in there. Or is it being destroyed wholesale by literally an invasion? One thing is clear. Yahuwah will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Now, I honestly don't care too much because of the genetic lines. Oh, well, who's Amalek? Are we talking Edomites? Are we talking Amalekites? Are we talking Hittites, Perizzites, any other? Well, Canaanites. Yeah, lots of Canaanites. That's kind of the general grouping. What matters, folks, is who we serve. It's easy to see by the fruit. Now, people can lie. I've certainly known many people. I'm sure everybody here has as well. Oh, I'm a Torah obedient servant. Oh, I'm a good Christian. Oh, I'm this or I'm that. Well, I've seen people put their hand on the Bible, swear to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, and lie through their teeth. Can't tell you how many of those I've seen. So it's one thing, in other words, to say something and lie. It's another thing what you do. And finally, it's a whole different thing entirely to invite people in who by their fruit and by their word indicate quite clearly that they intend to destroy your God, your law, your Constitution. Well, maybe we haven't had that for a while anyway. And your very lives. And force you to submit. Where I want to go as we begin to kind of tie the ribbons on everything today is the place that I've alluded to up front. That is the chapter of the book of Matthew, Matityahu, number 5. And you know this. This is the beginning of what is called the Sermon on the Mount. Literally, the first public address that was given by Yahushua in the land begins, and I'll go through a few of these. Usually I skip to the part that is, the most difficult for many people who are coming out of ex-Christianity to put their heads around. That's verses 17 through 19, but we'll get there. But remember, this is his first public address. It says, upon seeing the multitudes, he went up on a mountain. He was seated, his disciples came up to him, and he opened his mouth, and he began to teach them. And he said the following. We've all heard these words. It begins with what is referred to as the Beatitudes, and it's a great rhetorical device to begin a wonderful, memorable address. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for the anav, by the way, I'm sure is the word there. Remember, Moshe, he was a nav. I like the term teachable, by the way. That's also what it means to be meek. You've heard me teach on that probably if you've been around through the, it wasn't that long ago. Story of Moses begins, and we're actually going to get it here pretty soon. Anyway, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, ha'aretz. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. I hope that includes almost all of us.
for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see Elohim. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of Elohim. And blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness. Now, what's righteousness? Another way to put it, Torah obedience. Oh, we don't like that term anymore, do we? No. Blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of Torah obedience, righteousness. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. We're going to come back to that theme about this kingdom and who gets to be there and who doesn't and why it matters. But I'm going to suggest if you don't even know the name of the king, if you don't understand what he says, if you won't do what he says, you think you're going to be invited in? Whether we're talking about a kingdom or a family or a house or a wedding feast? Blessed are you, he says, when they revile you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Let's pause. What's going on now? We got people that are being invited in who will do precisely that because that is precisely who they serve, Allahu Akbar. Are they alone? Didn't the Nazis that came in before them do the same thing? Aren't the Nazis that are living and working in Washington, D.C., along with the Islamic Allah-obedient types who literally... Well, I saw a story the other day. There are more Muslim Brotherhood-affiliated people in Washington now, at the height of this particular part of the cycle, than there were communists at any place or time in history, including during the McCarthy era. Don't think there weren't a lot of them. It's just that in comparison, the Muslim Brotherhood has done a lot better job of invading Washington than the communists of that era were able to. But don't think that there's not some ideological similarity and that ultimately they don't, all of them, have the same identical hatred for the God of the Bible. That at least has been consistent, this war from generation to generation. Rejoice, though, he says, and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in Hashemayim. Remember, he says, they persecuted the prophets before you as well. I'm working up to the verses that we're going to spend some time on. You are the salt of the earth. But wait, if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It's good for nothing. I guess that's an easy one. But to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. And you know what? We're seeing that, aren't we? People who aren't good for much except being trampled. A lot of them were in Washington and in New York and other places and putting on burkas and saying, trample me. Whether they knew it or whether they'd been dumbed down and negatively educated to the point where they didn't even have a clue what they were really asking for. You, though, should be the light of the world, a city set on a hill that cannot be hidden. You don't put a lamp under a basket. You put it on a lampstand. It gives light to those who are where? In the house. So let your light so shine before men that they may see, he can't say this. Jesus didn't say this, did he? Did he talk about works? Well, in spite of the lies we've been told, yes, it says, let your good works be seen so that they might glorify your Father in heaven. Wow. You know what? Here's the point. There is so much, in other words, that people that essentially are spending their time saying, we got to invite people in who hate God. We do a pretty good job teaching it, but it would be helpful if we had a few more people coming in through the doors that were willing to kill people, whereas we're just willing to prattle on about things we either lie about or never bothered to read in the first place. Do not think, he says, that I came to destroy the Torah, or the Navi'im, the instruction, or the words, the writings of the prophets. I didn't come to destroy, but to fulfill. What does that mean? The words literally mean to make it clear to you. What was it that was said in this portion? Is Yahuwah among us or not? They strove. Well, folks, if you don't know what the word says, how can you tell? He was there in the form of a pillar of cloud by day and a fire by night. He did actions. great works, brought them out of bondage by a mighty hand, so that they would know Ani Yahuwah. And here these people are, whining, striving with one another, and indeed with him and his appointed leadership, and they have the chutzpah to ask the question, is Yahuwah among us or not? And we wonder why it's not as easy to see today. If we don't understand what he said and what he did, and the fact that the prophets also made these things clear, why are we not surprised we miss this? We start thinking all these gods are the same. Well, they're all the same if you don't read the book. If you are ignorant, if you're dumbed down, if you're double-minded, don't expect anything from the real God. Go to your fake gods. Over and over and over again it says that. He'll even choose your delusions for you. And we got a lot of that going on. So, don't think I came to destroy the Torah or the words that were written prophetically so that you would know. I didn't come to destroy, but to make it clear, to fill all of this up with meaning, to reveal essentially the things that you would see the dots coming together, to prove again what it means, Ani Yahuwah, that he is who he says he is, that he will do what he said he will do, not just through his servants like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but through the prophets that came later. For assuredly, I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away. That's kind of key. Check it out. I'm looking. Yep, there it is. I see earth. I see heavens. Still true. So it hadn't happened yet. Not one yod nor one tittle will pass by any means from the Torah till everything, coal, is fulfilled. Hadn't happened yet. Hey, let me ask you this. Has the name of Amalek been blotted out, the remembrance from under heaven? No. What we got is he still has war with Amalek from generation to generation. So, not one yod or tittle, not a tiny part of his instruction, his Torah, in spite of the lies we've been told by these same minions of Satan who walk in men's shoes. Maybe they put on fancy robes. Maybe they put on a fancy hat. Maybe they tell us, oh, they have cemetery education, so they can teach you how to choose death. Open those floodgates, bring them on in. Let's let Amalek whack on us with the edge of the sword for a while. The double-minded man shouldn't expect anything different than that. Verse 19 applies right now, right here with the people that we see as we flip on the TV and look at the televangelists. Or the various liars in various costumes. Whoever, therefore, it says, breaks one of the least of these mitzvatim, mishpatim, hukim, commandments, my statutes, judgment, whoever does the least of those things, breaks them, and then tells you, it's great to do so. If he repents, shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. Those who do and teach, they shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Folks, that's exactly what we need to do. Do and teach. Forget all this BS we've been told about, oh, it doesn't matter what you do. Just say the sinner's prayer, get your get-out-of-hell-free card, and go and bring in the Amalek. All of those who hate everything he says. How blunt can it be? How, you know, the singular message, I think, that I'm trying to get through that kind of underlies all this, if we don't understand what double-mindedness is, if we don't know whether we're going out or coming in, why are we not surprised that we can't recognize the difference between his word and those who are teaching it and those who walk in it and people who come but to kill and destroy on behalf of, guess what? Some other so-called set of mighty ones. I don't care what they call them. They are all servants of the same old adversary. Now this is interesting. The next verse, verse 20 says, because I'm going to tell you here, unless your Torah obedience exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you ain't going to enter the kingdom of heaven. What was it that characterized the scribes and the Pharisees? We read through places like Matthew 23 over and over again. Well, by and large, they may have talked the talk, but they didn't walk the walk. Matthew 23 uses one word over and over and over and over and over again. We see it in Mark 7 and other places. Hypocrites! You hypocrites! Even sons of the adversary. What's the problem with them? In a lot of cases, they're teaching Torah. They just got a whole lot of other crap, too, that they add on. Nowadays, we have the Romanized, paganized Catholic Church, and it subtracts from. They add some stuff on, too. But the whole point is, it's not about what's written. It's about what, as I've said many times, men say God, we don't even use his name anymore because we don't know him. Men say God should have said if he was as smart as they think they are. How do we know this? Well, we got 500 of them twisting scripture, writing the president saying, come on, bring in Amalek. We want to destroy the rule of law and everything that the God that we claim to serve says to do. It's not enough that we rewrite concerning marriage and concerning money and concerning literally just about everything in the book. We're not done yet because there's still people walking around with their heads attached to their shoulders, I guess. There's still a few folks out here that think that when he says he means something, he really does. Can't have that. Now, the next few verses, and what I'm going to do at this point is begin to summarize, but it makes the point very well. Use a rhetorical device. I'll read it in verse 21. You have heard it said, to those in days of old, you shall not murder. Thou shalt not murder. And that whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I tell you, don't be angry with your brother without a cause, and so forth. The moral, the consistent device, the rhetorical device here is over and over and over again. I think it's six times in these next, well, towards the end of the chapter. He says, you've heard these things said. Here's what these liars have told you. You've heard this said, you've heard that said, you've heard the other thing said. But I'm going to tell you, basically, what is really written. How is it that people can figure out whether or not Yahuwah is among us? Well, for one, if they're being taught lies, or if they're hearing the truth, if you will, straight from the lamb's mouth. You've heard it said. I'm going to tell you what it really says. And in every case, you can look through the book here, you can read the Torah, and you can understand that oftentimes what he's doing is he's connecting the dots with several of the elements of his own instruction. And it's very clear. This, by the way, is this chapter, probably the single place in the Brit Hadashah, the New Testament. And again, you know I don't like that word because it implies that the old is done away with. Really, Brit Hadashah is more like renewed testimony or Brit covenant. It's renewed because you all broke it. But the consistent message is, I'm not changing it. I'm not changing the tiniest part of it. I'm just explaining to you how these scribes and the Pharisees, they're doing stuff that was explicitly prohibited. Deuteronomy 4:2, Deuteronomy 12:32, adding and subtracting from. You got popes with their funny hats, worshiping Dagon and Ishtar. They are doing the same thing. More subtracting from. They changed the Sabbath day. They changed the rules about what's food and what's not. They changed the rules about marriage. Pretty well, they're kind of like the Supreme Court. They're taking everything, calling evil good and good evil. Don't you understand? You're not listening to what is written, and it's not that hard. You've heard it said in days of old, you shall not commit adultery. Now listen to this one. Here's one that I sometimes like to do just because, well, it ought to be funny. It's not. It's sad. You have heard it said, days of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you that whoever looks at an Isha to lust for her has already committed with adultery with her in his heart. What's he talking about? Oh, he's raising the bar, Mark. He is changing the rules. If you just look at a sweet young maiden, you've come. No, you're missing the whole point. He just told you he's not raising the bar, not changing the rules, not adding to or subtracting from. Anybody that does that, saying don't obey the word, ain't even going to get in the gate. So So for crying out loud, don't call him a liar before he's even finished his first speech. You're not listening to the point. You've heard all this crap said that is not true. I am going to tell you what is true. Now listen carefully. Yeah, thou shalt not commit adultery. He's not saying that's not true. It is. But if you look at an Isha, what's an Isha? Well, you know what? In the Hebrew, the word Isha has actually more than one meaning, but generally Isha means woman. Yeah, yeah. It means wife. The way this should correctly be translated so that people don't get the wrong idea is if you look at a married woman, you have already, for the purposes of lusting, you look at her to lust for her, you've already committed adultery in your heart. What's he saying? Hey, read the rest of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not covet your neighbor's Isha, wife. You covet your neighbor's Isha. That's not the same. Let's not confuse ourselves. That's not the same as looking at Bill's wife across the street and saying, hey, that's a wonderful woman. She's beautiful. She's a great cook. She's a loyal, wonderful, faithful companion. You want a great wife? There's a picture of her. And you say to Bill, you know, you've got a beautiful, wonderful wife. You should be thankful. There ain't nothing wrong with that. That is a far cry from saying, I want her. I want to do whatever it takes. Thought precedes action is the other element of what he's teaching here. And he's saying you got to be able to connect the dots. Look at the bigger picture. What is Torah about? Torah is about getting your heart in line so that you walk, so that your actions follow the things that you know you need to do. Paul, Shaul, says it a little differently, and it's a great way to phrase it. He says, take every thought captive in obedience to the instruction of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. All right? It doesn't mean you don't look at a woman and think, whoa. What it means is you take the thought captive. You do not allow the thought to become lust and coveting to the point where it's not that big of a step to the action. I once had a friend tell me something I remember ever since on this. He says, well, you know, Mark, there was this really good woman, a good-looking woman, and I lusted for her in my heart. So I figure, what the hell? I've already committed adultery. Might as well do it. You think I'm kidding? I'm not. This is exactly the way the mind works. This is the human condition. Hadn't changed. We don't know if we're going out or coming in, but we know that whenever something doesn't quite sit well with us, we're happy to twist it, to lie about it. Furthermore, he goes the next step. Somebody, this is another one. I'll point to this as a pitifully bad translation in the New and existing King James. Furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, it's not what it says. That's not what he said. Okay? If you go back and read Deuteronomy 24, when we get there, I'll teach about this in more detail. But in summary, there is a difference in the Hebrew, in the language and in the understanding, between what Americans call divorce, because we don't even know what marriage means, right? We think, oh, marriage means you got to get a license from the justice of the peace. And if the justice of the peace says you can boink a boy and get a license for that, that's okay. No, that does not make it marriage. And if you don't understand what marriage is, why do you think you're going to get a good clue about what dissolution of it amounts to? Deuteronomy 24 says the word there, and it's right out of this week's Torah portion, shalak. What's it mean? It means to put out, send away. So Deuteronomy 24, should I read it? Let's read it out of the King James too. Talks about the process for putting away. When a man takes a wife and he marries her, oh, does that mean he gets the justice of the peace permission? Nope. What does it mean? It means he consummates the union. There is offer. Will you marry me? Yes, I will. And then there is consummation. They become one flesh. We've seen it. We saw it with the story of Isaac, Yitzhak, and Rivka, Rebecca. He took her into his tent. And then he loved her. We get that wrong too. Took her into his tent. He took her, and she became his wife. There's the essence of the process. So when a man takes a wife and he marries her, She finds no favor in his eyes because he's found something unclean about her. So what does he do? He writes her something called a Sefer Keratuta certificate. He puts that in her hand, so he gives her written documentation, and then he shalaks her. He sends her out of his house. And when she's departed, she can go, and indeed, if she does, she becomes another man's wife. Well, he too can go, and we get the same process word for word. He writes out the Sefer Keratuta, sends her, shalaks her out, and, the process is clear. To talk about divorce is at least more than one step. It requires not only a sending away, but a certificate. So, what is this saying really? Furthermore, it said, whoever puts away his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce, a Sefer Keratuta. So far, so good. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason, except she is an adulteress, let's put it that way, causes her to commit adultery. Problem. The word there is still shalak. You can go back even to the Greek and you can see it. It's not the same as divorce. He sends her away. If she is already an adulteress, can he turn her into an adulteress? No. Doesn't this make logical sense? So in other words, if she is an adulteress because she has committed adultery and he sends her away, he hasn't made her an adulteress. She already was one. So that explains what verse 32 is saying. But we miss the other part of it. Again, he is teaching, let's read what it says. You've heard it said, if you're going to send your wife away, give her a certificate of divorce. Okay? But I'm telling you, essentially, part B of this, if you marry a woman that has been sent away, but does not have a Sefer Keratuta, she's still married. You're still committing adultery. Doesn't it make a lot more sense if we actually read what the Torah says? Compare his words to the instruction that is also his words and say, yeah, what's he teaching? He's teaching a broader principle. He's teaching a whole lot of stuff. And indeed, we could spend a whole hour just talking about these few verses and pointing out all of the ways in which this is a really clear explanation of the Torah. What does the last part of Matthew 7 say? When it was all done, they were amazed. Let me read it from the King James. When Yeshua had ended all of his teachings, the people were astonished at his teaching because he taught them as one having authority. I think that should be capitalized. Not as one of the scribes. Why? Because really, what he was demonstrating by his actions was he was the Torah made flesh. Do you think, just maybe, is Yeshua among us or not? Was one of the questions that might not need to be asked, and indeed already answered. So there are some other parts of this. I could go through all of it. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Numbers 30 says, man makes a vow, he'd better keep it. If you don't intend to keep it, what should you do? Don't make it at all. Just let your yes be yes and your no be no. Again, teaching Torah. You've heard, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Of course, today, we have people that hate the word of Yahuwah and say, yeah, take out somebody's eye. No, that's not the point. It's called measure for measure. The teaching is about, hey, what's your eye worth to you? If you accidentally or on purpose, you put out somebody else's eye, putting out your eye doesn't help them at all. But let me ask you a question. This is the way we ought to be thinking about some of the measure for measure teachings in the Torah. What's your eye worth to you? What would you be willing to pay to that guy that you harmed so that your eye isn't taken out? Well, maybe that's exactly what you ought to do for him. It's a lot better understanding of Torah as written than what we are seeing and what we have been told it should have said if God was as smart as men. At that point, I guess what we need to do is pause again and just say, so where are we? What is all of this making clear? Folks, I have contended for a long time that, yes, it's good that Hitlery isn't in the White House. And that doesn't mean at all, though, that there isn't still a battle ahead. And we can see it. And I'll say that there have been some things that President Trump has done Some of them that give me pause. I'm not a fan of the imperial pen, as you can probably guess. But on the other hand, the executive order that had to do with stopping immigration is nothing if not right smack out of, yes, there is a constitutional authority to establish rules for naturalization and immigration. The 1952 McCarran-Walter Act, in fact, does, and it literally gives the imperial pen of the president the power to do that. So where the hell does the court get off doing all of this stupid stuff? Answer, there's a battle here. We're still having war with Amalek from generation to generation. Are we going out or are we coming in? No doubt, the human condition hasn't changed. We got lying, cheating, stealing, and whining still going on. But the moral of the story remains the same, too. Choose this day whom you will serve. We better know who we serve. We had better understand the entire lesson from this book, from Exodus. Ani Yahuwah. I am who I am. I am who I say I am. People ask this question, is Yahuwah among us or not? Well, folks, if we've kicked him out, and then we are double-minded to the core, well, we better not expect anything from him. What does it mean? Well, he tells us, come out of her, touch not the unclean thing, be separate. That we can begin to do. Hey, we can say, you know what? Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Don't make any agreements to serve the almighty satanic state. I hope... I know there's NSA people and recordings and all that kind of stuff going on. I'm actually hoping there might be some agents of Big Brother who put their hand on a Bible and took an oath. Maybe some military folks. And I know a lot of good police and military and probably even some federal agents. But they need to ask themselves the question, who am I serving? I put my hand on a Bible. I took an oath. Have I ever read the document? Have I ever read the thing I put my hand on and swore to Yod, He, Vav, He before that I would support this other document? And indeed, are there a whole lot of things that I'm being told to do that are about as clear, idiotically in your face, obvious, that are violations of that document? Whether we're talking about warrantless search and seizure or prohibitions against speech or denying people due process and just hauling them off. Or just plain lying and allowing terrorists to have their way when I should be defending the people that I swore this oath to. So many ways that we can see that, yeah, whether we like it or not, there's a whole lot that is going on today. Wrong people are coming in. The people that should be, in fact, making sure that we know who we serve, they're not being well served. That's to put it mildly. Ani Yahuwah. We're supposed to know that. That's literally the essence of the very first commandment. It is that simple. I am. Just know that. The rest follows. If he is who he says he is, then the first few things in the so-called Ten Commandments, and we'll get to that in just the next couple of weeks too, the 10 words, Devarim, what do we owe him? What is our rightful service to him? Keep my Sabbaths. Do the things that I say to do. And then we get to the next half of them, basically. Thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not do, well, things that amount to essentially the same process. Coveting. It's not hard. It is, however, consistent. And no doubt about it. If we will honestly look at what's going on in the world today, this is the bottom line. This battle with Amalek from generation to generation is continuing. And we had better know who we serve. And we need to be not double-minded so that we can, in fact, count on his protection, his provision. Because he will do the things that he said and continues to say that he will do. Those promises, we can literally, you can bet your life upon them. But understand that they're conditional. Read the if clause and make sure that if you expect his protection, your rightful service, and this is in this portion too, do. How long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my instruction? That's a good question, and it fits today. Let's pray. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad, Abba, we thank you. We thank you that your word is true. We thank you that you are who you say you are, and we pray that you would help us. Give us eyes to see, ears to hear, and help us to know that you are who you say you are. And Father, we pray that you would be among us, that we would see and know your presence, that we would see and know the things that you have for us, and more importantly, that you would show us the things that we need to do so that we can be good and faithful servants unto you, so that we can be prepared for what lies ahead, that we can know the times and the seasons, that we can be not deceived, so that we can, in fact, fear not, and that we can stand and be still and see your Yeshua. Help us, Abba, to be witnesses. Help us to do the things that, that you said. To be strong, to be meek when we need to be peacemakers, to be ready in all of these ways to inherit Ha'aretz. We pray, Abba, for your protection, for your guidance, for those who seek to be called by your name, for those who are in positions of power and authority, that they would in fact do what you would have them do, and to do what they in fact have promised before you to do. If they're not, Abba, we pray that another would take their place. Guide us in this time ahead. This we ask in your set-apart name. For you are Yahuwah Rapha, our healer, and you are Yahuwah Nisi, our banner. Hallelujah. Amen.